Welcome to Rise Up at Work. I'm Dr. Deepak Boothra, and today we are unlocking the work life you were meant to live. You're watching Now Media Television.
This episode of Rise Up at Work is going to explore something very unique. We're going to look at workplace health, disability management, and productivity that is treated as connected leadership responsibilities rather than separate HR compliance problems. I brought on board someone very interesting. We have Michelle Coates with us today. She's an occupational therapist and the founder of Blue Balance. She comes to us all the way from South Africa, and I am so happy to have her here. On this show and on this specific episode, we always talk about real professionals and how they grow and lead and create impact in today's fast-changing workplace. Today's topic affects every organization, but it is often handled too late or has a certain stigma attached to it. The relationship between employee health, disability management, productivity, and meaningful work is a bit convoluted, not straightforward. My guest is someone that I really appreciated when she said she would love to be on board. Michelle brings what I call guidance, sheds lights, helps workplaces design practical health and disability management solutions. She talks about policy. She supports training to employee. She looks at case management, return to work strategies, and workplace accommodations. A lot of you on this call are sitting there thinking, okay, Deepak, this is unique. This is different. How is this going to help me? It is. From someone who comes with 3 decades of work experience, I can assure you, a lot of us do not understand what happens at workplace health and disability. And I really want to have this conversation with Michelle to give us a perspective that many of us don't understand, relate to, or talk about, but it exists. And many of us may need those resources. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks, Deepak.
My pleasure having you, Michelle. This is going to be an interesting conversation. Michelle, you are doing something which, you know, a lot of people have heard of. Could you take a minute and tell me what led you from, you know, occupation therapy into workplace health and disability management, your background? What's that calling, as we would say, that brings you into this domain?
So I started off as a traditional occupational therapist, and I worked in the clinical space for a couple of years. And I then ended up going to Switzerland. My husband got a contract in Switzerland and I went along with him, and I couldn't work as an OT there because of the language barrier. So I landed up working in a pharmaceutical corporate environment, and I really enjoyed this environment and just all the background aspects of health management. And I really, when I came back to South Africa, I really wanted to get involved in policy development and process development, and looking at how I can support individuals with medical conditions and also support clinicians and practitioners that are working in the clinical space to help people with medical conditions, specifically with regard to staying at work or returning to work.
It's a funny thing, you know. And people don't actually realize this. They sometimes think that, you know, disability, health, and these type of things matter to a very small percentage of people, right? The reality is that it applies to 100% of employees, because, you know, you don't know when and how and when, in which context you're going to ever use it. So my request to everyone listening in is to kind of lean in here. We are talking about something that is available to a lot of people. That's something that impacts 100% of us when we need it. It's like insurance, right, Michelle? You don't miss it until you miss it. I don't know how to explain that to you, right? But Michelle, let's keep digging in. I like the origin story. It's always nice to get origin story, which is like so different, right? I mean, you have a workplace location and you end up with workplace disability health. When I try to peel this onion back, right? When you look at the modern workplace, where do organizations or even listeners listening into the show most often understand this connection between employee health and productivity? How does that work?
So to be honest, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding in that space. And I believe that stigma contributes to that. And I've seen stereotypes that managers have had that have prevented them from hiring people with medical conditions because they thought that a person with a condition wouldn't be as productive as their colleagues, because they assumed that someone who had a certain diagnosis might take more sick leave or be more costly to the business. So there is the stigma that affects the perception of disability in the workplace and how productive these individuals will be. And that affects individuals a lot from a recruitment point of view. And you will see people with disabilities or with medical conditions are often very hesitant to disclose that at the recruitment stage because they're so worried that they will have a manager or an HR practitioner that is interviewing them that will have this element of prejudice that might actually result in them, you know, being discriminated against at that recruitment stage. But I've also seen it when a person is working, you know, and they come forward and disclose a disability because either they get injured or they've had a condition and it now worsens.
That was going to be my question, Michelle, because I was going to ask you, Michelle, the recruitment phase is always one of those tricky ones, right? Where you and I know you're already sitting in this position where you want the job. You want to give forth your best foot, as we call it, right? You sometimes try to overcompensate by acting a bit more than what you are. And you try to, I like this word stigma you use, right? There is always that. But Michelle, let's dig in deeper into when you are on the job, right? And when we talk about health and productivity. And I know that we haven't mentioned the word mental health here yet, right? But at the end of the day, mental health, and I would assume these are also subcategories of disability and health and stuff like that, right? There's a massive stigma around mental health as well. And in my own journey as a people manager, I've led teams of hundreds. And I can assure you, Michelle, one of the first learnings and observations I got was that as a manager, I was so ill-prepared to actually understand, empathize. I won't use the word sympathize, empathy. Because sympathy is easy. Empathy is when you actually can relate to what's happening because you've experienced it yourself. And I have seen what stress, continued obligations, working late, right? And we in the 80s and 90s, Michelle, we used to have this, you know, weird way of looking at the world. Leave your personal problem at home and just bring your work brain to the office. And I think that that led to a lot of people adopting behaviors and stuff that just didn't bridge the stigma, actually deepened it. So I like the stigma element to you. And I can see, let's just dig in a bit more, right? So here we are, I'm a company. And I have this obligation, right? How have you looked at this right balance that they need to create between supporting employee well-being and maintaining business performance? That's been one of the issues. We got the stigma issue. And I'm going to dig deeper into the stigma side of things as well, right? Because that's very, very important to peel off. But I'm just very, very intrigued. Here are organizations whose desire is to make money, and now they need to support employee well-being. And sometimes I get the impression like someone's, you know, got a stick in their hand and these guys are simply doing this because they're scared the stick's going to whack them on the backside. What's your take on that? Have you seen a big change in that mindset?
So I focus a lot in my space on the balance between empathy and operations. And it's, unfortunately, it's a bit of a gray area. And I wish I could give you a formula that could say, at this point, this is where you sort of draw the line. But it looks different for every person depending on their condition, the work environment that they're in, their social environment. But it's really an obligation of an employer to do everything that they can to implement accommodations that are feasible within their space to try and support an employee who has a medical condition or a disability. But at the same time, we need to understand that at some point, you have to draw that line. If you as the employer or the line manager or HR practitioner have implemented reasonable accommodations, you've offered the support, you've followed the recommended plan for the agreed upon timeline, and that individual still can't do the inherent requirements of their job, it then might be the point where you need to say, okay, we now need to look at following some kind of a medical incapacity process or a disability leave application. And it's always difficult as a clinical person. I think they're always pushing on and always trying to do as much as they can to keep the individual at work. But you really need at some point to say, okay, you know, we've done everything we can and unfortunately haven't been successful in accommodating or supporting this person, and maybe they need some time away from work to recover. But it really is the obligation of the manager to put the effort in. And I completely agree with what you're saying. We've all seen the policies. A lot of the training is just a tick box exercise. And, you know, people sit in the virtual training sessions and do other work whilst they are attending the training. And it shouldn't be like that. You know, we really are wanting people to get to be engaged, to ask questions, discuss scenarios, so that when they are faced with a situation where they have an employee who has a condition, comes to them, discloses it, they know what to do. They know how to have that discussion, and you know, they know how to offer the empathy rather than sympathy.
Michelle, this is really interesting. I really like that answer, and I'll tell you why. We have this notion that an occupational therapist like you is going to come on this call and is going to talk and pound, you know, and pontificate and give us guidance that employees matter and this matter. But I really liked your answer because you brought balance into it, right? Now, if we talk about balance, and this balance is the most important one, there is an obligation on someone to understand. Michelle, we're going to run out of time, but I have to ask a quick question. What are some of the early warning signs that an employee may need support before a situation becomes a disability claim or prolonged absence? In my case, I was sitting in a meeting and I actually noticed that the member that was attracting my attention, who used to be very vocal in meetings, was very quiet, also was very snappy with some of his comments. And that gave me a feel that something was off. So in my one-on-one, when I dug in, that's when I actually realized he was going through prolonged stress and stuff. And we had a conversation. We actually got him into one of the employee assistance programs on wellness. And he actually went and met someone outside. And he came to me 6 months later and said to me, thank you for what you did to me. Now, that happened because I myself had my own tryst with mental health, with, you know, stress and with, you know, trying to figure out how, because I had three managers in a row that gave me a lot of grief. So, Michelle, very quickly, what are these early signs that one should look out for?
It would be changes in behavior, exactly like you said. When you notice someone is acting differently to how they normally are, it would be absenteeism. So when you see somebody is taking a lot more leave than they have in the past, it would be presenteeism. They're coming to work, but they're not engaged. You know, they're dropping the ball. They're not meeting their deadlines. And then the fourth one would be performance issues. So when you really see a decrease in their performance, and previously they were a fantastic employee, and now they're really struggling to, you know, to meet their deadlines or achieve their targets. So in a nutshell, that would be my quick answer of things that a manager should be looking out for.
Four elements you listed there. What we're going to do now, Michelle, is get ready for the next segment. Coming up next, we'll look at disability disclosure, sensitization, and how leaders can create workplace conversations that are respectful, practical, and effective.
We'll be right back with real stories, fresh insights, and action steps to help you rise up at work without losing yourself. You're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Your ambition built your success, but somewhere along the way, your ambition took over and started running you. Hi, I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm an executive coach, sales strategist, and host of Rise Up at Work. I've spent 3 decades inside corporate walls, a long time. I've been witness to how pressure rewrites purpose. And when you lose sight of purpose, how the right mindset can help you reset and write a greater story. Rise Up at Work premieres soon on Now Media Television. Remember, it's time to move from surviving to thriving. It's time to rise up at work. And we're back. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and you're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Let's keep reclaiming your career and learning how to truly rise up at work.
Welcome back to Rise Up at Work. Stay connected to this show and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand, anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. You're on the move? Catch the podcast version at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and news to lifestyle, culture, wellness, and beyond, Now Media TV is streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. Before the break, Michelle and I were getting deep into discussing workplace health and, you know, how do we separate this from productivity, leadership, culture, and the nuances, and what are the elements and things that a manager should be looking for to sense something is up. Now we're going to move into a bit more sensitive and important areas as well, disability disclosure, employee trust, and the way managers respond when someone needs support. So in segment one, we identified a couple of things that Michelle called out as to how to identify. We're going to see maybe, can we get deeper into that conversation and see how can we step forward to provide that support? Michelle, question for you then. What makes disability disclosure so difficult for many employees, especially when they fear stigma, career consequences of being misunderstood? We kind of touched upon this, but I really want to do a double click on this one.
So employees are so worried that if they disclose their disability, they will either have a negative reaction from their line manager. The line manager might not understand, and it might impact their career progression or their job security. So that's one of the really big things that they worry about. they will often worry about the confidentiality of the information that they're sharing. Will this disclosure of mine get to my colleagues? Will, you know, people be talking about it in the lunchroom later today? And that is something that employees are very, very fearful of. And then, you know, just general stigma. You know, how am I going to be treated by my manager? How is this going to impact me throughout my career? And I've seen this in examples where, you know, people have spoken to me and said, at a previous employer, I disclosed and X, Y, and Z situation happened, which was so difficult for me. And I actually had to leave the company because of the stigma around that situation. And that's why I don't want to disclose at my new employer, because I don't want to be exposed to that. So very often it is just that unfortunate experience from a manager that maybe hadn't been through any kind of sensitization training.
Here's the fun thing also. You know, I don't want to sound like we're bashing managers, right, Michelle? I think the reality is that we're human. And if you've not gone through a specific, the word you used was sensitizing the training, right? And I really do call upon managers to understand that it's one of their obligations. People have always asked me, as a people manager, Deepak, how did you know what was the right thing to do? And my response was, what would I want people to treat me as, right? Isn't that a very ancient, simplistic framework that we use in religion as well, right? We treat others the way you would like to be treated. So I would always ask a manager that if you were doing the disclosure to your senior exec, what would you expect of that senior exec? That's exactly what you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about psychological safety. When I first came across that concept, Michelle, I must be honest with you, it sounded like mumbo jumbo to me. But then it hit me. If I'm in a meeting with my executive and I am sitting there completely terrified that what is he thinking of me, or that he's going to cut me off, or that he's going to tell me what a bad idea, or he's going to tell me, I pay you so much and you give me such bad ideas. And by the way, everything I'm saying has actually happened to me, Michelle. Mm-hmm. I was in a meeting where I was told, I pay you a director level salary and right now you're thinking like an analyst. Should I cut your salary? I was just sitting there. Sure. Now you tell me, Michelle, when you have that type of a conversation, do you really think you're going to get the best of me? And this is where the reading of the individual is so important, so important. Now, we are getting into very interesting territory, because I can tell you right now, my listeners are now starting to lean in, because each one of them can see themselves in this conversation, right, Michelle? So now, Michelle, mm-hmm. we touched upon, you gave four ideas, right, as to what are the triggers or the things that you should look for. And I don't want to use the word trigger, because that's also become one of those things that's got a connotation to it, right? But mm-hmm. let's dig into this a bit and ask a simple question. How can employers create a safer environment for employees to speak up about health conditions, disability-related needs? And I want to keep calling out mental health, because that's a big area of focus of mine, because I actually have family members with severe challenges. I've been a caregiver for a long time, and I'm hypersensitive to that topic. So if you could just kind of shed light, how do we go about creating the safer environment?
So it starts with policies, and I don't think policies are the answer to all of the problems in the space, but I definitely think that they're a very helpful guide. You want to have those policies in place so managers know, where do they start, what process do they follow, what are, you know, the implications in certain areas. So policies are very important, and just the sharing of policies. I have been in environments where I've spoken to managers and said, well, you know, let's refer to your disability policy or your mental health policy. And they weren't even aware that they had them. They didn't know where to find them. They'd never read them. And so that sharing of policies is essential for new managers. But then even along the way, you know, and this should probably take place every year, just a revision of the policies. So starting with policies and then explaining to employees what the confidentiality process looks like should you disclose. And I think that that is one of the most important areas, especially when it comes to non-visible disabilities. And that's a huge percentage. About 80% of disabilities are actually invisible or non-apparent. So we want these people with these non-apparent conditions that are fearful of disclosing because of stigma or of what their colleagues might say, to know exactly how their medical documents will be stored, that nobody else will have access to them, who will know about their disclosure, you know, what will the process be that will happen. And I think once we've dealt with that confidentiality, those policies have been socialized and individuals know what the process is and what the benefits are to disclosing a disability, I definitely think they will feel a lot safer to come forward and disclose that disability and, you know, have those discussions with their managers.
Into this, because I really want to dig into this, because I really want to get some advice from you. Michelle, you deal with managers, you look at managers, and you can sometimes see an exemplary manager. You sometimes see a manager that you know is just doing the bare minimum too. I had an ex-boss, and this guy was just too good. We're sitting in a meeting just north of Johannesburg, you know, mid-Rand area, and he suddenly starts talking about the new policies that the company had come in, the new code of conduct and other stuff, right? And he then started talking about it in a way, Michelle, that blew my mind, because it was clear he had read it. It was clear he had understood it. And then he said something which kind of sealed it for everyone. He actually said, hey, guys, I've been thinking about quitting smoking. So I actually called the number that was in the guide. And I actually asked him if they had a well-being program that could help me. And we found one. And I'm going to be starting to talk to someone and we're going to see if they can put me onto some patches and stuff like that. And I was like sitting there very quietly humbled, because at that point I didn't understand what he was doing. But as I became a people manager, as I started growing, I actually understood. When you are the first one to stand up and be vulnerable, right, and state that you yourself are partaking of the fruits of this policy, and when you make the word policy become easy to say and easy to understand, you are setting the right example, right? I'm not saying that human beings are herd mindset, but I've always said this to people. If you want something done, if you want a certain type of food to be eaten first, people are going to watch you eat. And if you are going to drop that food into the garbage that are not going to eat or eat it last, how are you going to tell the world what to do? So Michelle, if you look at exemplary managers around you, right, what do you think are the ones that are really being impactful, doing that is unique, which my listeners could take away? Any people manager listening in, what are the one or two pieces of nuggets you would share with them in terms of what they could personally do, professionally do, to make the stigma go away, to make this adoption increase?
So that is such a good point. And people often say with children, you know, don't tell them what to do, show them what to do, and they will follow what it is that you're doing or what you're demonstrating. And it's exactly the same in the workplace. Your employees can read your policies, they can look at your processes, they can even attend your training sessions. But it's when they see something being implemented, they go, oh, this company's serious about inclusivity. Oh, these managers have actually been through that same situation and come out, you know, well on the other side. Maybe I should try the same thing. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the big worries for individuals is that if I disclose my disability, this will affect my ability to grow in the organization and my career progression. But as soon as they see a manager come forward and say, I have a condition, or I struggled with this and I followed 1, 2, and 3 process and this was the outcome, they immediately say, okay, well, he's a manager. He's had difficulties. He's followed the processes and look where he is, and he's continuing to excel and to grow within the business. It would be safe for me to do that too. So I think we underestimate the impact of leaders' support and intervention, and not just at your line manager level, but all the way up, you know, to exec and C-suite level as well, to have those managers come forward and have the difficult conversations. And sometimes it's even a conversation about a family member of theirs that's gone through something difficult and how they supported them. But, you know, it makes them more human, and it ties that thread between illness and success within the workplace.
Michelle, there's so much that we could unpack there. There's so much you just shared with us, right? Let me just slow it down a bit here. I have leaders who are listening in. I want them to actually dig in deep into Michelle's guidance there, right? At the end of the day, you need to set an example in the other work you do. And I think what we are agreeing to, Michelle, is you also need to set an example in the way you approach the destigmatization of this entire, right? If there are processes that you want others to partake of them yourselves, share openly. And I would love to dig into the desensitization training element a bit, but again, we're going to start wrapping up and get ready for segment three. Michelle, I really enjoyed this. What we're going to do is that when we come back after the break, we're going to talk about return to work programs, accommodations, and the practical systems that help employees re-engage successfully. Michelle, thanks for a great conversation. I'm really looking forward to segment three.
We'll be right back with real stories, fresh insights, and action steps to help you rise up at work without losing yourself. You're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Your ambition built your success, but somewhere along the way, your ambition took over and started running you. Hi, I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm an executive coach, sales strategist, and host of Rise Up at Work. I've spent 3 decades inside corporate walls, a long time. I've been witness to how pressure rewrites purpose, and when you lose sight of purpose, how the right mindset can help you reset and write a greater story. Rise Up at Work premieres soon on Now Media Television. Remember, it's time to move from surviving to thriving. It's time to rise up at work. And we're back. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and you're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Let's keep reclaiming your career and learning how to truly rise up at work.
Welcome back to Rise Up at Work. We are continuing our exciting conversation with Michelle about health, disability management, and the future supportive workplaces. Yes, a mouthful, a lot of words there, but I want you to just slow down. We have discussed mental health. We've spoken about stigma. In this segment, we're going to focus on what happens after an employee has been away from work or is struggling to remain productive because of a health condition. I want you to look at this, not from the lens of just only disability or being supportive, but also from the lens of performance management. Michelle, I think it was in segment one, actually spoke about the balance that is required. An organization has to support, has a policy, but an organization also has to deliver on its obligations as a company, right? At what point do the two reach each other? That is a different conversation, but it was a very, very important one. What I want to do is I want to kind of start the ball rolling, Michelle, by asking a very simple question. What some of the pieces of work you've done, right? I think there was some reference to a return to work program where you try to reintegrate a large percentage of disability claimants into the workplace. And I think what was curious for me, what would really I think I wanted to understand was, how would you define what made that program effective? What are the learnings that you got from that?
So it was when I was working in the disability insurance space, and we were helping individuals to go back to work either in their own job at their own employer, in a different job at their own employer, and sometimes even into the open labor market at a different company entirely. So that's the context around the project. And when we designed these return to work programs, we focused on a few very, very important elements. The first one is early return to work. And that could mean any period of time, really, but as early as possible. Some cases, we were able to get people back to work 4 months or 5 months after the date of their diagnosis or their injury. Other times, it was a little bit longer, a year later. Sometimes it was even 3 or 4 years after their date of diagnosis. But we tried to do it as soon as we could. And when you look at the disability stats, it's really, really clear that the longer it takes for you to go back to work, the less likely you are to return to work. The stats tell us that if somebody has been away from work for 6 months, there's only a 50% chance that they're actually going to return back to work in a successful capacity, and that percentage decreases to 10% if they've been away from work for 2 years. So early return to work is absolutely vital, and then having the right stakeholders involved. And when we ran that project, we had occupational therapists who had a special interest in vocational rehabilitation act as our case managers, and they tied all the threads together. So they connected all the stakeholders. And that means all of the stakeholders. They interacted with the family of the employee, the insurer, the other treating medical practitioners. They were interacting with the employer and, of course, with the employee themselves. So they brought all those people together and made sure everyone was on the same page so that there wasn't any miscommunications or contrasting information. And I think that was vital in making sure we had success. And there was also some incentivization for individuals who were a little bit hesitant or a little bit less motivated to return to work that the insurer offered. And that also helped just give a little bit of a nudge to help people to actually start actively engaging in the process.
Michelle, can I challenge you on that a bit, right? Let's let's do some stone throwing for a second there. I'm a manager. I now I'm dealing with an individual that's been out of work for 4 months. And Michelle, you know the problem with budgets, right? If someone is out of work, doesn't mean that you've replaced him with someone else. Most likely you have a budget, but you can't spend it because the person is either in or out. I don't know if you've had those type of situations where you now have a situation where the manager is the one that's creating a ruckus or a noise that I want a final answer, want someone to come on board. How do, Michelle, you accommodate those type of conversations where you know where the manager or the employer is coming from, but you also need to manage the dignity, you know, of the person on the other side who has taken that disability? Isn't that like a vicious hard rock and stone, right, as the saying goes?
It is. It really is, because you can understand where the manager's coming from. They've got targets to reach. They're trying to protect their other employees in the team who've probably now taken on additional responsibilities whilst this employee's away from work. So they have a lot of aspects that they're thinking about, and it's understandable when they are hesitant or, you know, when they're not so engaged in the process. But I think what's really important to get their buy-in is to firstly discuss the company's policy. So normally those kinds of aspects are addressed in the policy. What is the obligation of the manager and the employee for individuals who have medical conditions or disabilities? So we bring that forward initially. We also look at legislation. If there's some kind of government or you know, overlying legislation that actually guides how people should be treated in the workplace if there are people with disabilities, that also helps a lot. And then we agree on a plan. So we will say, okay, realistically, this is what we believe would be the amount of time this person would need, the reasonable accommodations, the equipment. And we have that discussion with the manager. And that's so important, not to come in as the case manager or the insurer and say, this is what you have to do, because often that will be the end of the line, but rather to have a discussion and say, this would be ideal, and have the manager come back to say, well, that's not feasible, but we could potentially do that, but we need a little bit of extra help in this or that area. So the negotiation between the different parties to figure out a program that works, and then to have that case manager checking in regularly with the manager and with the employee to make sure they're heading in the right direction and adjusting it. And then when you get to the end of the agreed upon time period to look and determine, were we successful? Did we reach the goals that we had hoped to reach? And if not, to look at either other possibilities within the business, if that's feasible, or you know, some kind of separation or disability leave for the individual.
Michelle, here's a very odd question that I'm going to ask you. And this is going to be one that's most likely going to get me into a lot of trouble. In my interaction in the last 34 years, right, I have found, and I'm really thinking twice before I ask this question, but I have to, Michelle. Michelle, and this may be something that you could say that, you know, Deepak, I can't speak from experience or I've not observed this, but in general, my feeling is when I meet internal HR resources at an organization, when I meet, let's say, legal people that are there to protect an, the environment or to enforce those policies as well, correct, right? There's always a limit to, that's why the rules are written. And that's why I also tell people, I know that a lot of people look at their employment contract from, and they look for one thing. Did I get the money they told me they're going to pay me? Did I get a signing bonus? How many days of leave do I get? And that's the end of it. No one reads the other stuff, right, Michelle? And here's the fun part. You will typically be disengaged with the organization. And people tell me that, you know, money is number one on the list. I get that, park that. But all else being equal, if money is not the issue, it's usually something else. And I've noticed one thing. I do a lot of coaching, Michelle, and I've coached 1.5K people in the last, let's say, 15 years. In those 15 years, the single source of disengagement has actually been when someone actually needed the company to stick with them for something that they were struggling with. And when they saw the company did not, they wanted to exit. And I know it sounds odd, but I wanted to observe it. And I want to just get a feel from you is that when you talk to the same HR and legal person as a manager internally, they all look like decent, sane people, right, Michelle? But I've also seen them on call with some of these individuals taking on some very highly structured, very legal, very stone-faced, judgmental look. As someone who's dealt with those type of individuals, do you sympathize with the position they find themselves in, or would you say that there needs to be a softness? And I know this puts you in a very odd situation, but I'm just keen to get your opinion as to what you feel could be a behavioral change or something different that organizations could do before going into this, what I call legal mode.
So managers typically get into those roles because they are really good at their job. They've probably been in a hands-on operational position. They've showed that they're good at their job. They can do that well, and they move up slowly and eventually find themselves in a people manager position. And often what I've seen is that when you get to the people management position, you don't necessarily get the training that you need to manage the people. You know, nobody sits down and explains how to have these difficult discussions and how to really manage these sensitive situations. So I do sometimes sympathize with a manager who has no experience dealing with a certain medical condition or being sympathetic to an individual, and now they have this dropped on them and they don't even know how to respond. Often managers have the straight face because they don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to get themselves in trouble. So they prefer to say less or say nothing or act very formal. And I believe that the sensitization training and the awareness training can help managers to overcome that and to gain a little bit of sensitivity and awareness in having that initial disability disclosure discussion, knowing what words to use, what words you shouldn't use, what disability etiquette is for individuals, understanding that two people with the same kind of condition would look potentially very, very different, you know? So I do think that I see where managers are coming from when they have this legal face, as you mentioned it. But I believe that with the right amount of practical training and discussions, they definitely can overcome that and gain an element of empathy and understanding for individuals that are disclosing disabilities.
100% with you. My message to leaders listening in is as follows. I once met someone that I had removed from an organization in a workforce retrenchment scenario, right? Reduction in workforce scenario at an airport. And he came up and he was very polite with me. And I said to him, you must have hard feelings about the way we parted, right? He said, no, you treated me with dignity and respect. I remember that more than I remember the fact that I lost my job. And to me, that's the only message I would give to people. Michelle, let's get ready for segment 4. I really enjoyed this conversation. When we return, we will connect policy, training, leadership, and culture. And we're going to talk about how organizations can build workplaces where people and performance rise together.
We'll be right back with real stories, fresh insights, and action steps to help you rise up at work without losing yourself. You're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Your ambition built your success, but somewhere along the way, your ambition took over and started running you. Hi, I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra. I'm an executive coach, sales strategist, and host of Rise Up at Work. I've spent 3 decades inside corporate walls, a long time. I've been witness to how pressure rewrites purpose. And when you lose sight of purpose, how the right mindset can help you reset and write a greater story. Rise Up at Work premieres soon on Now Media Television. Remember, it's time to move from surviving to thriving. It's time to rise up at work. And we're back. I'm Dr. Deepak Bhutra, and you're watching Rise Up at Work on Now Media Television. Let's keep reclaiming your career and learning how to truly rise up at work.
Welcome back to Rise Up at Work. Stay connected to this show and every Now Media TV favorite, live or on demand anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. And if you're on the move, which many of us are, just catch the podcast version at www.nowmedia.tv. From business and news to lifestyle, culture, wellness, and beyond, Now Media TV is streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. So, before the break, Michelle and I were discussing return to work, accommodations, and early intervention. And I think we had a great conversation in terms of some of the challenges that managers face. And we also discussed this 20-faced manager, right, Michelle? Michelle, now I'm going to kind of like start wrapping up and see if I can pick up the odds and ends that are still rattling in my brain. I want to talk about leadership, how organizations can build policies, programs, and the cultural element, Michelle, is what I want to dig into. The goal is that, you know, how do we build the culture that supports employees while strengthening the workplace as a whole? And I'm, to be honest, putting that down on paper is easier than actually how it's done. But Michelle, when you are designing training programs around absence management, mental health awareness, ergonomics, or disability sensitization, what exactly do you want leaders to change first? What's that foundational stuff that you're looking for?
I would say the first thing they need to change is their understanding of disability and their preconceived ideas. I've spoken to managers who have said really inappropriate things or really stigmatized things about individuals with certain medical conditions because they didn't know better or because they had once met a person with a certain condition and now believe that everyone who had that condition behaved in the same way. So I think really just to start by getting managers to understand that you can work if you have a medical condition or a disability. You can be successful, you can be promoted. There are people who are entrepreneurs and doctors and CEOs who have mental health conditions and are extremely successful. So I want that to come across always at the beginning of these conversations so that managers start to change their perception of illness and disability and understand that you can be a successful employee with a medical condition. And, you know, then once we've established that, really just to give them the confidence to have the conversations and to know what to say when having conversations around disability disclosure or requests for reasonable accommodations. And, you know, just to give them examples of scripts that they could use and words and phrases that they should and shouldn't use so that they can feel comfortable in having those conversations.
Michelle, I still remember my first script and I just fell over laughing. You know, when I became a people manager, one of the scripts they gave us was how to fire someone, believe it or not, right? And one of the instructions which blew my mind and for 1 second rattled me was always make sure to sit closest to the door so that if things go south, you can exit fast. Michelle, I sat there stunned for 20 minutes. What exactly are we doing here that would require me to run out of that room? Because it never hit me, because that's how clean my heart was. The reaction mm-hmm. that potentially could happen to someone who's now on the receiving end of what I was about to do. Now, mm-hmm. or of course, did they really need to write it the way they wrote it in that booklet or that script? I'm not sure. But it did make me realize that there are scenarios where reactions can be very intriguing. So when you called out scripts, I just had this memory flashback. That initially when I read the script, I said, surely you must be joking. But then I realized that, no, we're not joking. We're trying to explain how sensitive these topics are, what can go wrong. And I laughed about it at that stage, but today I think it's also about dignity, right? It's not about me running out of the room to save my life, right? Which is what they were implying. Mm-hmm. I think it's also about the fact that I need to focus on the reality that people react to these type of information and things in a very unique way. And as a manager, it is my obligation to make sure I come mentally prepared, if not scripted, to respond, right? And I think when you're mentally prepared, the script comes naturally. And I'm a sales coach, and Michelle, I've always told people, if you're going to rely on scripts, you're going to fall apart when the agenda goes off the script. How are you going to recover then? And that, I think, is a very important message you shared. That's when you, if you know the policy, understand the intent of the policy, understand the values behind the policy, then you can actually figure it out. And even if you're stone-faced, you still can have some decorum. There was a word you used, Michelle, etiquette, if I remember right. And I'm very sure my listener would have wondered, what does etiquette have to do with it? Etiquette has a lot to do with it. In my case, that etiquette was remembered as dignity saving, right? Or face saving, potentially. The man did not feel disenfranchised. His dignity was not taken from him. And that's what he remembered. Michelle, this is getting really interesting because I did not really think that we're going to get this deep into this type of a conversation, but I think it's very powerful, right? Now, we spoke about disability sensitization, as you called it, right? Michelle, mm-hmm. I want to kind of talk about this. How do you say this? When you are designing, right, and you look at these value systems and the structure, right, what should a strong workplace health or disability management policy make clear for both employees and managers to make sure that it lives up to what's expected of it? Are there like some basic things you look for in it?
Definitely. So it should always include the legislation, and it should be guided by the legislation. You know, you can't exclude legislation from a workplace disability policy. So that's definitely the first thing. It should always talk to the roles and responsibilities of the different stakeholders. And I will often see a bit of confusion between the HR and the line manager around whose job is it to have that conversation, whose job is it to follow up on that. And one might push it onto the other because they don't feel comfortable doing that. So really clear roles and responsibilities for the different stakeholders and what they need to do, including the employee. And I've even seen employees who think, oh, well, I just need to go forward, tell them I have a condition and what I need, and they must all just do it. However, the employee needs to know that once they've disclosed, they might need to bring documentation, they might need to have certain discussions, they might need to sign consent for this information to be shared with the health and safety team. So they need to be aware of what their roles and responsibilities are as well, so that this can be a successful process. And just a detailed overview of what the process looks like. And so often, I think that is where policies fall short, because people will look at a policy, they'll say, oh, I want to disclose, but I don't know who to contact, and I don't know what will happen after I contact them, and I don't know how long it'll take. So, you know, actually, it's too risky, and there's too many unknowns. So to include all that kind of information in your policy allows an individual to pull the policy, read that, and know what is required of them and what that process will look like. And that will often give them the confidence to come forward and follow that process.
You know, what's really interesting, Michelle, is that when I first got a job in India, right, I'd worked overseas for a large part of my life. And it was my dream to go back and work in India. I mean, I worked in India for 9 years, Michelle, right? And I landed and I was a people manager with a team of 7 people. I get to work, and at the entrance, there's this massive board, which has pages and pages and pages stuck on it. So I went up and I asked someone, what's this? Is this like notices? Is this cafeteria times and stuff? And the guy said, no. This is the Occupational Safety and Health Act that has to be published and kept on a wall so that all employees can be aware of the policy. I was intrigued. And I started reading it. And Michelle, it was written in such wooden language that it completely was not making a single word of sense to me as an exec. Mm-hmm. So the question I was asking myself is, wow, so it is published here because it is required by law to be published, but it's written in such bad language. And then I looked across and there was a little stand right next to it. And on the stand, it actually had a pamphlet that the company had put together. It's an ex-employer, if I don't want to name them. But I actually picked up that booklet, and I then realized that a company can be known by the way it translates these obtuse, very vague, very impenetrable, right, documents or requirements from law into something that was easily digestible. And when I read that pamphlet, I actually then realized that, wow, this makes so much sense. But when you read it in black and white, it didn't make a lot of sense. Let me just park that. It was just an observation I wanted to share with you. Now, yes, we spoke about design, right? And you said that you got to start with the law. And the reason why I said my story was because some people start with the law and end with the law. And I think you carried on to explain that it's just not there. Right? You need to take it to a point where people actually understand it. People know what's going on. Michelle, I want to start wrapping up. If I am a company and I have limited resources, where should I begin if I want to improve employee support and reduce unnecessary absence? What advice would you give me to structure something on that?
I would say to start by having conversations with the employees and the managers in your organization. You can't start implementing interventions and applying policies and doing training if you don't know where the problems are. So have conversations. If you already know of individuals with disability in the workplace, have discussions with them around what's going well, where their concerns are, what changes do they think should be made, and then start applying those changes. Have conversations, whether it's through direct one-on-one conversations or maybe a questionnaire type format with the managers and the supervisors and team leaders around how confident do they feel in managing somebody with a disability. And I'd really make it very practical. I would explain, you know, if somebody with bipolar mood disorder had to come to your office tomorrow and disclose that to you, would you know what to say? Would you know how to support them? And I would you know, send those questionnaires out or have those conversations with the managers and even other employees in the organization. We often forget about the employees who don't have disabilities or medical conditions, but they're the ones who are supporting these individuals. They're the ones who are helping to make an inclusive environment. So it's important to know what level are they at in terms of understanding disability and knowing their role in supporting their colleagues and understanding stigmatized or stereotyped thoughts that they might be having. So you really need to start by getting the understanding.
I'm going to stop you right there because I think that's where I want to leave this listeners on a high. In this conversation, Michelle and I have been talking about You Think Differently, my listener, about health, disability leadership or workplace support, right? I want you to listen to this conversation both for your own betterment, but please do share it with a colleague, an HR leader or a manager who is navigating these questions right now. The future of work requires both performance and humanity. And I think Michelle's given us a very good perspective on that. Thanks for listening to us.